Look, it's time for some vitamin D. In this case, double D, donkey droppings. Get that vitamin D. Woo, gobble it. Oh my goodness. Saving on dog food now. Food inflation doesn't matter here.
Welcome to Brighttown Broadcast News for Monday, January 8th, 2024. Mike Adams here. Thank you for joining me today. Hope you enjoyed that intro there of my dogs getting their daily intake of vitamin DD. Can never have enough vitamin donkey do there. Or maybe that's vitamin DP, like donkey poo. I don't know. We've got an interesting show for you today, although it'll be much shorter than usual. Although I will be featuring an interview with Jake Morfonios from Blackstone Intel, and he's an expert in Saudi Arabia and the Middle East. And I interviewed him actually in November, so kind of shortly after the October 7th events. A lot has happened since then, but this interview is highly relevant, and I regret that I had not published it before now. I realized this right before Christmas, and I didn't want to publish it during the break, so I've held it, and you're going to get it today. That's coming up after this short broadcast. Now, if you heard my podcast last week, I was talking about the Boston honeypot sex trafficking trap ring thing that apparently ensnares a lot of these military leaders and big pharma executives and big tech leaders and so on. And you may recall, there was a menu of services that had been texted to some of the clients, and this was covered, I think it was a UK Daily Mail article, and the menu included a price list for something called BB. And I was asking what is BB, and I thought, well, maybe it's BB Netanyahu, you know. Maybe you have sex with the Israeli prime minister. That would you pay extra for that? Or I'm kidding. But I was like, what is this BB? And I specifically said in the podcast, do not tell me what you think BB is, because I don't want to know. And then I said, I think it just means like maybe a bondage bunny, like somebody dresses up in a bunny suit and then they play bondage or whatever. Maybe it's Senator Lindsey Graham in a bunny suit, you know. We get getting smacked around a little bit, you know, like playtime. You know you like it, bunny. You know, because he's got a gag in his mouth. Who knows? Who knows what that scene looks like? I don't want to know. But, of course, one of you, even though I asked you not to, one of you texted me the following photo that is actually a leather bunny bondage hood. And so I want to show you that. Apparently, I can't even, like, my satire doesn't even go far enough because it's real. It actually does exist. There is a bondage bunny hood face mask thing for I don't know, whatever kind of furry playing around people do. But there's one, and it's on Etsy. It's on Etsy. So there you go. And I've never bought anything from Etsy, and I had no idea that Etsy had all this bondage type of stuff. But how much you want to bet if I tried to sell like vitamin D on Etsy, they'd say, oh, no, that's not allowed. You know, FDA restrictions or maybe glutathione or N-acetylcysteine or something. You can't sell N-acetylcysteine, but you can sell open ass bunny costumes on Etsy, in case you were wondering about that. And I find that a little bit twisted. How about you? A little bit twisted. And now, regrettably, my Etsy search history in my browser includes bunny bondage. It's just the things I go through to bring you this broadcast. Okay, I've got something else for you here that's on the lighter side. This is a really funny video with a little bit of political commentary. It's in Japanese. I mean, the text is Japanese, but the spoken word is English. And in Japanese, it is entitled, If Italians Were Zionists. And I want you to watch this video. It's only a minute 20, but check it out. This is what would happen if Italians were Zionists. Okay, check it out.
Hello, nice to meet you. Do you live here?
Yes.
With your family?
No, I live alone. Sorry, who?
Oh, that's even easier. This is my house.
What?
Sorry, my English is not very good. Is this Bath?
Yes. See?
Is Bath a Roman city?
I see. You're joking. It's a lovely joke. Because you're Italian, you think that you own this place because...
No, there is no joke. The Romans occupied England in the 5th century, so anyone of Roman descent has an historic claim to this land. Now leave, my family is waiting outside.
Oh my god, you're serious?
Yes, my god Jupiter proclaimed it. So now pack up and peace off, pretty boy.
Your English sounds pretty good to me. Listen. You can't just turn up to someone's house, evict them, and then move in because you think you're the descendants of someone who lived here thousands of years ago. You know that's ridiculous, right?
It's pretty wild, isn't it?
Yeah.
Hey guys, come in. Auntie Jupiterite.
Yeah, there you go. Hope you enjoyed that. Pretty funny how she was citing the Roman god of Jupiter. There. Well, Jupiter told us that we can take all your land and kick you out and kill all of you. Yeah. Oh, wow. Jupiter said that, really? So you must be the chosen ones. Yeah. All right, moving on to another video. I'm going to kind of verbally meme the following video, which Matt Bracken posted on X. I think it's pretty funny. This is apparently, I think it's an Italian cruise ship that something went wrong and it slammed into a dock and crushed this, I don't know, this other little party boat or something that's there. And I'm going to talk over this video to explain my meme. Like if I could put labels on this thing, what I think this is. Okay. Are you ready for that? All right, here we go. All right. So here's this giant cruise ship crashing into the dock. The cruise ship is BRICS currency. Yeah, so that's BRICS currency. Here it comes. And the little party boat there, that's the US dollar. And the people running around, those are economists. Economists, oh my God, BRICS currency. Here, it keeps coming. And the economists, they're trying to figure out how to stop it. They keep looking at it like, it's massive, unbelievable. And of course, the BRICS currency ship is so heavy and has so much momentum and it's backed by so many world nations, it's not stopping. And the dollar is just about completely crushed at this point. You can see a little bit of the dollar there. Oh, there's the dollar. Oh, not looking good for the dollar. But the economists are like, come on, let's see if we can pull this thing back. Come on, we're economists. We're Nobel Prize winning economists. Surely we can do something. Okay, that's it. That's the video. So that's what I think is coming sometime. starting in the summer of 2024. But that whole smash thing, that's going to take a few years actually to fully play out, but it's already begun. All right, now we're going to shift gears to something that seems to be coming up here that could be highly disturbing. Let me show you this map that claims to be the weather report coming up on January 16th for the continental United States. Now, it's a little bit low resolution, so I apologize for that, but this is the best image that I could find. Now, I want you to notice the temperatures on this map. And I can't say for sure this is what's coming. This is apparently one weather model prediction. But let me read you the headline from the UK Daily Mail. Arctic blast bringing temperatures of minus 50 Fahrenheit or 78 degrees below normal is forecast to strike the West and Midwest next week. An Arctic blast threatens to bring temperatures of minus 50 degrees to large areas of the West and Midwest. Meteorologists have said the polar vortex could sweep across the Pacific Northwest and roll into the Central and Midwest over the next 5 to 10 days. Apparently, there's something happening that is going to cause a polar vortex. At least this is what's being claimed. And in case you're wondering how crazy this is. Now, again, I have to caution you. I hope to God that this is wrong. Because we're talking minus 35 degrees near Portland, Oregon. Minus 30 on the Oregon coast. So like Eugene, Oregon, also crazy. Northern California, minus 15. Seattle area, minus 25. Parts of Wyoming, minus 57. And again, and parts of Idaho, minus 45. I hope this is not true. But this is what's being here mentioned at the UK Daily Mail. It says, weather outlooks from the National Weather Service's Climate Prediction Center show the cold blast arriving late next week for central and eastern parts of the U.S. The cold shock would bring temperatures more than 78 degrees below normal for this time of year. Meteorologists, here's what they say is happening, have argued that an ongoing stratospheric warming event over the North Pole could displace the polar vortex and pour cold air into the lower 48 states. Sounds like geoengineering to me. I'm going to get Dane Wigington on, and we're going to ask him about this. It sounds like they're trying to wipe out the food crops all across the Midwest. To me, the potential blast has been compared to the cold weather storm in February of 2021, which left 4 million Texans without power for 70 hours. Yeah, I lived through that, and that sucked. And I am not going to end up with no electricity this time. Believe me, I am ready for this one. The temperatures in central Texas, if this happens, are scheduled to be, well, like Austin will be minus 24 degrees, which it sounds insane. Even in February of 2021, it was 5 degrees, and that was crazy. And that killed so many things and so many animals and people. And we had no power grid at that time, too, because, you know, the power system wasn't ready for that. So that was the week from hell. I remember that very well. I remember sleeping in the freezing cold, and we had 8 minutes of electricity every 30 minutes because we had rolling blackouts. It was bad. Well, I want you to notice this map. I mean, Arkansas is like minus 30. You know, parts of New Mexico are minus 27. Colorado, parts of it are minus 45 degrees. This is Fahrenheit, folks. What do we got? Kansas, and the whole state's like minus 35. Missouri, yeah, about minus 38. Illinois, minus 38. These are not positive temperatures. These are minus temperatures, just to be clear. And what's weird is that this cold blast just goes on a certain path where actually some of the states farther north are not nearly as cold. So Montana is like, you know, like, what is that, like minus, in the minus 20s. Whereas, you know, Wyoming is like minus 57 in one spot. Can you imagine? Meanwhile, in Florida, it's supposed to hit like 15 degrees. Man, that's going to wipe out all the citrus crops. How could this be? How could this be true? I'm really skeptical of this. Now, if you go onto the UK Daily Mail article, there's a different map, a little different temperature gradient there that shows central Texas is minus 5. And that Missouri is like minus 15. And Wyoming is still, parts of it are minus 38. And even, well, Nevada is like 5 degrees, and parts of California are minus 2. And it says that parts of Florida are minus 8 degrees in Florida. Yeah, and the Carolinas are all below zero. And Louisiana, Mississippi, all below zero. The entire East Coast is about zero on this map from the UK Daily Mail. Do you believe this? Do you think this is what's coming in 10 days? Or 8 days, 9 days? I'm just going to put a big disclaimer on this. I'm bringing this up just in case it's true, but at this point, I don't believe it yet. I do not believe it. It's just that I lived through the great power outage of 2021, and that was hell to go through. And because of that, I'm going to be very, very cautious here. I'm going to err on the side of being way over prepared. All right, so let me mention a couple of things for you. Now, I've talked about diesel, storing diesel fuel to run generators, for example, or to run tractors, and then you have a tractor with a PTO and you have a PTO generator. It's probably too late to get all that stuff if you don't already have that, but guess what else you could do with diesel? With diesel, you can run forced air heaters that are very, very effective, that are very good. For example, you can get about a 175,000 BTU kerosene / diesel forced air heater for typically under $500. And it does require some electricity to run the blower, but the heat comes from either kerosene or diesel. And diesel is relatively inexpensive, especially if you buy red dye agriculture, you know, farm diesel. It's dirt cheap right now. And you probably should have some backup diesel anyway. I certainly do. And so, you know, with 500 gallons of diesel, you can run a kerosene diesel heater for months. You know what I mean? So you can produce heat if you have diesel. You don't have to use just electrical heat. And besides, the grid is probably going to go down. The other thing to keep in mind is that these forced air heaters, they don't use that much electricity. So what you can do is you can get some of these solar generators at BeReady123.com. Let me bring that up. BeReady123.com. And this is the same company that's our sponsor on the satellite phones, but they have these EcoFlow battery storage devices, which can be charged with solar. And these are really excellent backup battery devices that can run the blowers on forced air heaters. So what you can do in an emergency, you need emergency heat and the grid is down. What you do is you get yourself one of these EcoFlow portable solar generators. You know, the bigger the better, obviously. And then you get a forced air kerosene / diesel heater. Most of them are dual fuel. And then you fill it with diesel and you plug it into the EcoFlow fully charged. And then it will run for a very long time, depending on, you know, the size. So you can check those out at BeReady123.com. I know they're shipping right now. And you can recharge them with solar panels. Obviously, in case the grid goes down, you know, you can get some sunlight and charge them up. And they have onboard inverters and charge controllers and all that. You can use them, you know, to charge your other devices, you know, mobile phones or laptop computers or what have you. But running forced air heaters is a really practical thing to do with this. Now, I will mention this just with a safety disclaimer. You know, read all the instructions and follow all the safety protocols and what have you. But as I understand it, the way to make diesel work better in kerosene devices is to add a little bit of isopropyl alcohol to the diesel. And I mean very little. I'm thinking it's like, I'm going to look this up. I think it's like 5 milliliters per liter. Well, I'm checking my notes. I don't have that written down anywhere, so you'll have to look it up. But I do know that for space kerosene heaters, if you want to use diesel in them, they will burn a little bit more on the dirty side. But adding a small amount of isopropyl alcohol, or IPA, makes the fuel burn more cleanly, and it saves your wicks and so on. So just something to think about. Another reason to have some isopropyl alcohol. And for that purpose, I would have 99% IPA, by the way, not 90%, because you don't really want water in that. And of course, be cautious, exercise, you know, all kinds of fire protection, caution, you know, don't do this stuff indoors. Obviously, be careful around animals and understand these things can put out a ton of heat. So don't fire up like a 100,000 BTU forced air diesel heater in a chicken house, or you'll have, Kentucky fried chicken the next morning because you will cook your chickens. So please exercise caution and don't burn anything down. Just stay warm and be safe about it. Keep kids away from this stuff too. Kids and fires and matches and alcohol and diesel typically don't go together very well. But some other things to think about. If we get this kind of crazy cold weather that's being predicted in this one model, which I hope is not true, but if it is, you should think about your water source. You know, think about protecting your water pipes. Your pipes are going to freeze and burst. You'll have no water. Maybe your whole city will have no water. You'll probably have no electricity. I mean, we were warned about all this months ago. Remember NERC? I think it's NERC. Is that the National Electric Reliability Council, I think, or something? Something like that. They said that severe weather will bring rolling blackouts to the U.S. power grid this winter. Yeah, well, they're talking about next week, apparently, if this happens. So think about storing some water. Think about extra sources of heat. You know, blankets, protecting pipes. What do they say? The four P's, right? The four P's. What is it? Plants, pipes, pets, and people. Maybe in that order, too, depending on your priorities. Of course, it's for my dogs, it's five P's. It's plants, pipes, pets, people, and poo. Got to have the vitamin D to keep them going. The other thing to consider, of course, is your food supply. Because if the temperatures really get this crazy cold, well, you know, the power grid will probably fail, which means your local grocery stores won't be functioning. And depending on how cold it is, who's going to go outside anyway? Are you going to go outside in minus 35 degree weather? Really? Will your car even start? Can you even, you know, scrape the ice off the windshield? You know, don't lick any flagpoles in that weather. You'll be there a while. If you're going to use propane tanks, make sure you go out and get them now. You know, most of the people in the country are not yet thinking about this cold weather wave, if indeed it happens. And you know how it is when people hear about a hurricane is 10 days away. They're like, whatever. I'll get to it. And then when the hurricane's like 6 days away, some people start buying generators. And then when the hurricane is 3 days away, there are no more generators to be found. And then when the hurricane is 1 day away, you can't even buy bottled water. It's like, all you last minute people, you just wiped out everything. I mean, that's what happens when they're not preppers. The people who don't prepare end up being the worst offenders when it comes to, you know, hoarding and panicking on everything. So right now you're ahead of the curve. Like right now, you can probably go out and buy a generator. You can go out and buy like a kerosene forced air heater. You can buy blankets. You can buy a space heater. You know, you can buy stuff for a few more days. After that, probably not. Depends. Again, I hope this climate model is wrong. I do not want to go through this again. 5 degrees was as cold as I've ever experienced it in Texas, and that was way too cold. I don't want to be at minus 20. What am I going to do with all my donkeys and goats and everything? I'm going to have to round up everybody and put them inside. But start getting ready now, and I'll keep you updated as we get closer. Hopefully this forecast will change. It's a good time to buy diesel, by the way. Good time to stock up on it. Because, according to Goldman Sachs, oil prices may double because of these continued disruptions in the Red Sea that could have an impact on energy markets. This is according to Dan Stroyven. That's the Goldman Sachs head of oil research. He was interviewed on CNBC. And he said that if you've got a disruption of the Strait of Hormuz for 1 month, prices would rise by 20%. That's from 1 month. And then he says that if it continues, it could eventually double oil prices. Yeah. You know, imagine oil at, I don't know, $200 a barrel. It could get there because the situation is escalating in the Middle East. Now, China's shipping giant named COSCO has just announced it is halting all shipping to Israel. This was reported by Reuters. Chinese shipping firm COSCO has suspended shipping to Israel. Israeli financial news website Globes reported on Sunday. Costco offices in Israel declined comment. No more ships. No soup for you. No comment. Okay, we'll see how that goes. Now then, we have another report that says that Israel may lose the war with Hezbollah. And this is according to the Defense Intelligence Agency, that's the DIA of the United States. It says that Israeli forces would find it, quote, difficult to succeed in a two-front war against Hamas in Gaza and Hezbollah in Lebanon. And this was reported by the Washington Post, which, of course, is run by the CIA. So have you noticed how quickly this whole situation has changed? You know, at first, after October 7th, it was like Israel's going to crush Hamas, you know, in like 2 weeks. It's going to be over and they're going to kill everybody. And they don't have to worry about Hezbollah. No big deal. Now, the CIA mouthpiece, the Washington Post, is saying that Israel can't win a war with Hezbollah if they're also fighting Hamas. Huh? Could it be that there are over 5,000 IDF casualties already? Because that's how many injured soldiers have been reported in the local hospitals in Israel. Of course, the Israeli government says, no, it's just a couple hundred casualties. No, it's like 5,000. They're not telling the truth about that because the Israeli people would lose their minds and, you know, they would no longer support the war if they found out thousands of IDF soldiers who are really bad at soldiering, by the way. These IDF reservists in particular, from everything that I've seen, they don't know how to be soldiers at all. They've got horrible training, horrible attitudes. They're like snowflake reservists, basically. They don't know how to fight. They're afraid. They're cowards. They have no understanding, no trigger discipline, no rules of engagement. That's why they shot their own three Israeli people who had escaped Hamas. Those three Israeli guys that were trying to run away from Hamas and be rescued, you know, and they had their shirts off and they were waving and they were shouting in Hebrew, you know, and the IDF soldiers shot and killed their own people. And it's like, why did you do that? Well, they have no trigger discipline. They shoot anybody, even if they're unarmed. That's the training of the Israeli army. They shoot unarmed civilians all the time, including their own people. So, of course, they're taking high casualties. They're not really warriors. They're posers, you know? They're just kind of placeholders. I mean, the real warriors are, frankly, like the Hezbollah guys. Those are some... I mean, I'm not saying I agree with everything they do or their religion or their goals. I'm just saying, in terms of just raw fighting, warrior capability, those are some badass warriors. You don't want to mess with them. Same thing with Hamas. Those are some dedicated, badass dudes, man. I mean, go up against tanks barefoot with a sticky bomb. It's like, my God. Wow. That takes some cojones right there. So anyway, it doesn't look like Israel's winning this, does it? It looks like Israel is carrying out a residential demolition job in Gaza, but they're not beating Hamas. And they're most certainly not beating Hezbollah. And now the CIA comes out and says they can't win. They can't win. Boy, that's a sea change right there. First time we've heard that. And by the way, have you noticed just the kind of descriptions that are used by the West in their propaganda on war? Like, for example, when Ukraine is losing so badly against Russia right now, and we hear the Western media say that Ukraine's counteroffensive failed. The counteroffensive failed. Well, okay, that's one way to describe it. But a more accurate way would be that Russia defeated Ukraine's forces. The Ukrainian counteroffensive forces were defeated by the Russian military. That's the more accurate way to say it. I mean, it's no fault of the Ukrainian soldiers. They're not given the support they need. They're not given the training they need. They're not given... Yeah, I mean, come on. Most of the aid that goes to Ukraine ends up in the pockets of corrupt officials, both in the Ukraine and in the U.S. as well. It's not going to the soldiers for the most part. Now, unlike the Israeli IDF soldiers, the Ukrainian soldiers really are very courageous. They're very brave. They've proven it again and again and again on the battlefield. And they don't just cry like babies and run away. I mean, they sacrifice their lives to try to hold ground. They try to follow orders. It's just that, you know, the Russian army is just overwhelmingly strong and has obviously much larger numbers and a lot more artillery and more drones and, you know, more everything. Russia's industrial output is larger than all of the Western European NATO countries combined, other than perhaps Turkey. But Turkey's not involved in this war. So it's no fault of the Ukrainian soldiers. The Ukrainian soldiers are very courageous, brave people. But Ukraine has been defeated in that counteroffensive, yet the West never reports that. They just say, oh, the counteroffensive failed. And even that took them months to admit. You know, for the longest time, it was, no, it succeeded, kind of. You're like, all your tanks got blown up in the minefields. Oh, that was just a probing attack. We were just trying to see where the mines were. Right? That kind of thing. Oh, really? So you just blew up all your tank armor to find out where the mines were? Okay, so what comes next? Well, next, they would say, you would see this report of the Washington Post, next comes the real counteroffensive. Now that we know where the mines are, and we've marked them with the husks of burned out tanks, by the way, just to make sure we don't miss those, now we're going to launch the real counteroffensive. And you're like, okay, let's see how that goes. And then, you know, a month later, where's the real counteroffensive? Well, we've gained 100 yards, you know, things like that. And then a few months later, it failed. no bleep, Sherlock. We knew that 6 months ago. So we're seeing the same propaganda with Israel. You know, like, Israel's the world's best military force, and they're going to defeat Hamas in record time. And now, you know, a few months in, it's like, well, they can't really win. Oh, I thought you said they were going to just mop the floor with Hamas. No, they can't really win. We've decided we're shifting into a longer-term perspective. And you're like, well, what does that mean? Well, it means that we can't really beat Hamas, so we're just gonna wage war for a few years and then declare victory. So you're not going to destroy Hamas. No, you can't really do that. Huh. So you mean Scott Ritter was right again when Scott Ritter said you can't really destroy Hamas or Colonel Douglas McGregor. He was right again. He said you can't destroy Hamas because Hamas is an idea. And the more you attack them, the more they recruit. That's exactly what's happening. And you know, the last few days, Hezbollah launched, what was it, like 60-something rockets, mostly at Israeli infrastructure. I mean, like military comms and a military base in this one, I don't know, hilltop. I forgot the name of it. But Hezbollah is holding back. They're not even trying to really escalate this. They're not fighting a large scale thing. They're just sort of occupying the IDF from time to time. That's all they're doing. In essence, what do they call it in war? Like a fixing maneuver, I think, you know, where they're kind of fixing the enemy forces in place or freezing those forces, forcing the IDF to dedicate a certain amount of forces to northern Israel. And that's what Hezbollah is doing. They're just tying them up. So we'll have to stay tuned to see what happens with that. Hey, by the way, last week, did you know that the national debt of the United States government hit $34 trillion? And do you recall, by the way, when it hit $33 trillion? Well, it turns out that was only 4 months earlier. So we are now increasing the national debt at $1 trillion a quarter. And this may remind you of some of my predictions on this from, I don't know, a year ago, 2 years ago. I said at some point we're going to be at $1 trillion a month. Remember that? And oh, we're getting close to that now. And then I said we're going to be at $1 trillion a week. And then eventually $1 trillion a day. And maybe that's the final blowout. At some point, the whole thing just blows out and the dollars become worthless. That day is coming. We just don't know exactly when it is, but I was shocked to find that we're already at $1 trillion a quarter added to the national debt. That's even with record IRS collections of federal taxes, both personal and business taxes. You know, the IRS is cleaning up and they don't even open their mail. They're still cleaning up record revenues from the IRS. And yet, you know, Joe Biden and the Democrats are just spending, 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 spending like mad. Well, technically, Trump did, too. Trump increased the national debt by trillions of dollars himself, and so did Obama. I guess it's never going to end until it all implodes, but I'm just shocked how fast this is all accelerating. So this is just a reminder of what's coming. Remember, when dollars become worthless, think about things that will hold their value, right? Gold and silver, gold backs, if you want to consider those as well, private crypto in certain forms, like Monero, for example, Firo. In fact, Ruben over at Firo, he's got a big announcement happening on Firo soon. We're going to interview him coming up. Let's see. Beam is a privacy crypto. What else is out there? Well, there's also land. And if you want to look at gold backs, just go to my affiliate site. It's called Verified Gold Backs. That's plural. VerifiedGoldBacks.com. And there's where you'll see my laboratory testing results on the gold backs because they actually contain physical gold in them. In fact, you know what? After the interview today, I'm going to run a little report on the gold backs just to show you what they're all about and kind of show you some on video. I filmed something last week in the studio to show you that, so we'll put that after the interview today. But I'm just saying, $1 trillion a quarter? Folks, I mean, it's not hard to see the end game here. It's not hard to see. It's just like that cruise ship I showed you. That's the BRICS currency coming in and steamrolling the dollar. If the dollar holds any value, you know, 5 years from now, I'll be shocked. And I think the dollar could lose in the next 12 months. I think it could lose maybe as much as 50% of its purchasing power in certain areas, like maybe food and energy. And overall, the dollar may lose, you know, 20-25% of its value in 1 year, maybe more. Whereas gold and silver are holding value, and they always will. They will outlast the fall of the dollar. But hey, as always, do your own research and check with all your own super duper experts who probably, you know, if they're mainstream experts, they believe in the dollar, and they believe the FDIC will bail everybody out. They think the Treasury can always just print more money. So, you know, hey, if you want to listen to those experts, go for it. I'm not listening to those experts, but you should do your own research. That's all I'm saying. Hey, did you notice the new disclaimer that we have today? I wrote up a new disclaimer for 2024, and we show that now at the very beginning of every episode here. And it says the following: this information, or the information contained in this video, is presented solely for educational and entertainment purposes. Nothing in this video should be construed as medical or financial advice. Practice common sense safety protocols. And then it says, do not open the interdimensional portals without first checking with management. Avoid napping in the path of industrial robots. Turn off the chromosomal replicator when you're finished with daily cloning activities. Avoid asking the resident ETs to explain antimatter theory. Do not share your email passwords with AI agents, and stop asking if you can play with the time machine. So that's my new updated disclaimer for 2024. Hope you enjoy that. All right, with that said, consider supporting us, healthrangerstore.com, for all your storable food, superfood, nutritional supplement needs, personal care products, all that, plus my line of heavy-duty knives, co-designed with Dawson Knives. Just go to healthrangerstore.com, support us there, and then enjoy this interview with Jake Morfonios here. And after that, I'll have a special report on the goldbacks. Take care. Welcome to today's interview on Brighteon.com. I'm Mike Adams, the founder of Brighteon, coming to you from the Matrix today, as you can see with the background here. And speaking of the Matrix and gosh, the reality that's being shaped around us. We're joined today by a geopolitical analyst that helps to decode the matrix. His name is Jake Morfonios. His channel on X or Twitter is at Morfonios, and it's spelled like it sounds, but we'll give you a link later. But welcome, Jake. Welcome to the show. It's great to have you on.
Thank you, Mike. Good to be here.
Well, thank you for joining me today. This is the first time we've had the chance to speak, but I've seen some interesting things in your work that I thought were very insightful. So I invited you on to talk about it. So welcome. And where do you think we stand right now in terms of Middle East events and what's about to happen next?
Well, that's an idea, isn't it?
Yeah.
What's going to happen next? Well, I'll tell you what's going to happen next is more of the same. We see a repeating cycle. It's been going on for decades now. Israel will go in and pound Gaza. They'll take more land in the West Bank. The international community will twiddle their thumbs, pass some resolutions. Eventually, there will be enough of an uproar that politicians in the United States, whatever the sitting administration is, will start to get enough pushback from the public, and then they'll send the message to Israel, say, okay, we got to slow it down. Israel will then stop the mass murder that's going on, go to ground operations, go and flatten the area, take more and more land, and things will start to settle down again. And everybody will just pretend like nothing happens. Everyone will go back to watching whatever they watch on Netflix, and it'll just set things up to happen again. 3 to 5 years from now. That's what's been happening. What is a little bit different this time is the scale of the massacre has been so much bigger that there has been a bigger mobilization of the public than what we've seen with the operations that Israel carried out in 2008 that led to about 1,500 deaths, 2014 with over 2,000 deaths. This, with now more than 11,000 deaths, has really piqued the interest of a lot of people who normally don't pay attention to this.
Yeah, I'm sorry to jump in, but I've noticed that too. I mean, we're seeing massive protests in London and in many other cities, even in the United States, large protests. I've even had one in Austin, Texas, and I'm in Texas here. But this is different, I think, from everything else that Israel has done, in the sense that for the first time, we're seeing so much pushback against Israel's actions that, and people aren't as much afraid today of being called anti-Semitic because that's a BS excuse anyway. Yeah. You know, we can criticize what Israel's doing while actually being in support of the Jewish people, mm-hmm. especially Jews in America. We support Jewish right. people or all people, but we criticize Israel's ethnic cleansing. Are you seeing more and more signs of that kind of pushback?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I've been called an anti-Semite I don't know how many times over the decades that I've been covering this. And it used to sting a lot more, but it has been so overused that now it's just this knee-jerk reaction. There have been what really has contributed to the weakening of the anti-Semite claim against people is that more and more Jews, especially in the United States, typically the liberal Jewish population, the demographic, the rising generations, don't hold to the same kind of extremist views that their parents and grandparents did.
Right.
And because there are so many more Jews now that are saying, wait a second, you can't carry out ethnic cleansing in the name of the Jewish people. I'm a Jew and I don't agree with it. And so all of the attacks on, well, you're a self-hating Jew. Well, that only goes so far. When you have masses and masses of Jews taking a stand, you no longer just fling these epithets around. It loses power. And so this idea, the conflation of anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism, has really eroded. We've seen that a lot since the beginning of October, when enough people speak out and say, I'm not afraid of the label. Call me what you want, but I'm still going to speak out in defense of this unarmed population
right.
that's being cleansed from the land. That's what we've needed all along. Fortunately, this time we're seeing that movement.
I'm seeing also, I'm glad you mentioned that, but we're all getting an education also in mm-hmm. what is Zionism, what's the history of Zionism versus right. Judaism, which is not mm-hmm. the same as Zionism, versus Jewish people, who, yeah. of course, are not all Zionists. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I would say that most Jews around the world actually oppose Zionism at this point. Do you agree with that, or what's your take on that?
I wouldn't say it's the majority yet, but there has been a dramatic increase in the number of Jews that that take issue with it. Uh-huh. Even in Israel, there are Jews that are coming around and seeing that, wait a second, the way we're doing it, just the industrialized cleansing of the land of Arab Palestinians, that just doesn't look good. It doesn't sit right with me. The problem is that while we do see the common people in nations all around the world, every region of the planet, we've seen mass protests against what Israel is doing to the Palestinians. But they're not the ones, we are not the ones that hold the power. The people that hold the power are the small cabals at the top of most of these governments, and money is really what it comes down to. Right. Whoever controls the money controls the politicians, who controls the policy of the governments. And that's why the Palestinian people and the supporters of the Palestinians have struggled so much over the years to make any substantive gains toward Palestinian statehood. It's because there is a considerable difference in the economic capacity of the two sides. But again, that is changing as well.
Okay. This is valuable insight, Jake. And yet, with all of this pressure from the world right now against Israel, including pressure from the U.S., I should add, you know, the State Department, Anthony Blinken is increasingly demanding that Israel, you know, not displace Gazans and not take over the governance of Gaza, by the way. Mm-hmm. Those are two right. specific requests. But Netanyahu is just saying, basically, screw America. It's like, yeah, we need your battleships. Your aircraft carriers, excuse me. We need your cruisers. We need your Navy. Yep. We need your nukes. But screw you and whatever you want. Like, how long is that going to work for Israel?
Oh, well, it has worked quite well for them from the very beginning. I don't see that changing anytime soon.
Oh, man.
Unfortunately, I hate to be pessimistic, but taking a long-term view at this, if I had just been covering this since, say, October, maybe I would sound a little more, we're gonna see major changes. But I've been covering this since the late 90s.
Oh, is that right?
Wow. And very much so. And all throughout the Second Intifada, all of the operations ever since then. The problem is that Zionism is so entrenched in the American political system that trying to cut that out, it's like stage four cancer. Without really going to town and potentially killing the whole body in the process, you're really going to have trouble weeding it out. And so our political system Zionism is so entrenched in the system. The war industry makes so much money off of this.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
That the power, the true power, is not in the hands of the people. It's in the hands of the war industry. It's in the hands of this elite political class and the investor class over them.
Right.
So is that going to change anytime soon? Probably not. But that does not mean that we can't keep whittling away, keep resisting, keep up the fight, make substantive changes to the extent that we can. And quite often in history, there are key moments in time when all of the stars align just at the right time. And if you're ready and you've got an organization in place and you've got a system and a plan, you can capitalize on that and make a difference. And so that's what has to be done. We have to focus, first of all, on ending the hostility that's going on right now. Absolutely have to have a ceasefire, not one of these humanitarian pauses, which is, you know, propaganda, total garbage. That's not going to do anything.
Right.
There has to be an actual ceasefire. We have to restore the Gazans back to their homes in North Gaza, as difficult as that may be, because so many of the homes have been just demolished.
Well, right. And you can't bring back the dead. I mean, there would have to be a settlement where Israel pays the Palestinians tens of billions of dollars to compensate for all the murder and all the destruction.
I mean, that's not going to fly in Israel ever.
Yeah. Yeah, the problem is the Palestinians don't have their version of Halliburton to go into Iraq after we level it and then get paid from U.S. tax dollars and whatever can be bilked out of the Federal Reserve to rebuild.
Exactly.
The Palestinians don't have that. But the Arab world does have vast resources, and they are often maligned and criticized because they are not doing more financially to support the Palestinians. And I think that that's that is to the shame of the Arab states. But one problem is that so many of the Arab nations, most notably Egypt on one side and then Jordan on the other, receive hundreds of millions of dollars a year from the U.S. government to basically stay out of the conflict.
That's right.
So we're bribing them into not supporting the Palestinians. So it's not so much that, well, the Arab nations don't have the desire to help. The common people in those nations absolutely do. But what they're afraid of is losing the money train. They don't want to lose the dollars that the United States government is giving them, bribing them to make nice with Israel and let Israel get away with these atrocities.
Well,
that could change, though, if these massacres reach a certain point. One thing that we're looking at that could be a game changer and change this into something different from what we saw in 2008, 2014, and that is the agitation of Iran through Hezbollah is it's really concerning the Israelis, the Israeli military. If Israel, and right now it is the Israeli military that is more aggressive toward southern Lebanon than the other way around, if Israel does what the United States government is afraid it's going to do, and that is to so provoke Hezbollah that Hezbollah opens up a can of whoop-ass on them, then we have a big regional war that's going to break out. The reason for that is while Hezbollah is a heavily armed, well-trained militia that's 100,000 strong, Iran has invested so much money into Hezbollah. It's kind of their crown jewel. Out of the 15 proxy militias that Iran funds and arms, they're the biggest. They're the most notable. And they do the most in helping to prop up Bashar al-Assad in Syria and so forth. So if Israel goes and starts carpet bombing South Lebanon, like they did back in 1982, and we see Hezbollah really ramp it up, Hezbollah can give them a run for the money. They'll start striking Tel Aviv. They'll cause all kinds of chaos in Israel. And the will of the Israeli people will falter because they are not like the Iranians, who suffered just countless casualties during the Iran-Iraq War of the 80s. A lot of these nations in the region have been so conditioned through a lot of fighting, they can accept higher casualty counts than what the Israelis would put up with. I mean, we can see the response from October 7th. The casualties, the fatalities from October 7th has sent them into an absolute maniacal rage against the Palestinians.
No, really good point, but I'm sorry to interrupt, Jake, but I have to add this in. Israel is provoking Hezbollah, as you are well aware. I mean, there was a drone strike 40 kilometers inside the Lebanon border, just the other day.
Right.
And at the same time, Israel's speech, I think, I don't remember which Israeli official it was, but they were just saying recently that we can do to Beirut what we are doing to Gaza. Yeah. I couldn't believe they said that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that's a direct threat.
Right. Right. Well, that's what the Biden administration is dealing with right now. They, on the one hand, Biden has not wanted to rock the boat. He's wanted to sit aside and let Netanyahu carry out this industrial scale massacre of the Palestinians in Gaza. But at the same time, if Netanyahu succeeds in his ultimate goal, which is to draw the United States into conflict with Iran.
Yes.
That would be very bad for Biden and his reelection efforts. He's already reeling from problems with inflation and so forth. He's lost the Arab vote.
Yes.
They're not going to vote for him. But adding to that, the outbreak of war with Iran That would be huge. So it doesn't serve the interests of the Biden administration to go to war with Iran, but it does serve the interests of the far right Zionists in Israel. So Netanyahu is going to keep provoking Hezbollah, not so much a grand assault on southern Lebanon that it would be obvious that it was Israel that started the fight. They don't really want to do just enough to get Hezbollah mad to take a big swing. And then they, we've got our provocation. We've got our justification. We've got to go fight the terrorists. We've got to go slaughter them. Now, when that big bombardment starts and it becomes full scale war between Israel and Hezbollah, Iran is not going to let Hezbollah suffer the kind of degradation that would happen in that war. Hezbollah would hold its own. They would fight to a stalemate at the very least with Israel. But it would leave them in a state that where we would require at least a decade or more of rebuilding to get their numbers back up and so forth. Iran can't countenance that. So Iran would really jump in there, resupply, push their other proxies into attacking Israel, U.S. interests in the Middle East there in Syria and so forth in Iraq. And inevitably, that's going to make Biden look weak if he doesn't respond. And boom, you've got major conflict going on.
Right.
And it's I'm sure you know, it's no exaggeration to take it a step further and say, all right, well, if the United States is fighting Iran and you've got all of the Russian investment that has been poured for years now into Syria and into Iran, Russia's not going to sit by and watch their investment go exactly down the tubes and lose the geopolitical war on their turf to the United States. So now you've got the potential for direct conflict between Russia and the United States.
And it's very clear. We saw the Wall Street Journal publish a propaganda piece right after October 7th that they claimed linked Iran to, to Hamas, actually, which there was no evidence of that. They just made it up. But it's clear that somebody probably in the CIA told the Wall Street Journal, print this. We need a link between Iran and Hamas because Senator Lindsey Graham wants to bomb Iran always. Right, I guess he wants to bomb everybody.
Right. He wants to bomb everyone.
I call him No Limit Lindsey now because he says no limit to how many civilians we have to kill in order to enrich, you know, the military industrial complex. But
right.
I mean, I'm paraphrasing. He didn't say it exactly that way, obviously. But that's what he means. So it seems like, okay, so Israel is trying to provoke Hezbollah. The U.S. intelligence services are trying to provoke Iran into a counterattack. Mm-hmm. And it seems like the smartest thing that Iran can do right now is to just stay out of it, at least directly, like not launch missiles directly from Iran to Tel Aviv, but rather to fund their proxy militias and Hezbollah. Does that
right.
That makes sense, right?
That makes sense. And that's exactly what they're doing. That's how they fight. The goal is not a quick, decisive victory. That's not how Iran fights. That's not how their military is set up. It's about using proxies to the full extent possible, and when necessary, the Iranian military itself. But to carry out a long, protracted war that wears down the opponent to the point that the other side either has spent so much money or there's been too great of a cost to the citizenry of, in terms of blood and soldiers lost, that they withdraw. So that's why you've got it. As far as just like a straight up conflict, take Iran versus Israel. Neither side has a navy. Iran's got 19 submarines. Israel's got five of them. But really, when it comes to war, it's inconsequential. When you look at the ground army, Iran has 1 million. Soldiers in its military. Israel's got about 600,000, so you've got a difference of about 400,000. The difference, though, between the two ground forces is that Iran has a population of 77 million people from which they can keep pulling, and Israel only has 9 million people. So they can afford to lose far more people in a conflict than Israel can. And you could do a comparison of the power that they have as far as artillery and all of that. But Israel's got a far superior air force than Iran does. Iran's got a superior force of tanks and artillery. But what it would come down to, because it doesn't matter if Iran has all of these soldiers, it doesn't matter if they've got more tanks, you've got all of this distance you would have to cover from Iran to get over to Israel.
Right.
And between here and there, Israel could degrade the forces through airstrikes and so forth. So it comes down to missiles. Who has got the long-range ballistic missile capacity? And Iran could really challenge Israel in that way. They could fight from a distance.
They'd well, exactly. These,
and missiles that carry massive warheads that could cause massive damage. And so Israel knows this, and that's why they want the United States to come in and wipe out Iran, because Iran really is the foil to Israeli geopolitical expansion in the area. Because they don't want just the Palestinian territories. They would love to go back in there and take part of the Sinai Peninsula. They would love to take Jordan. They would love to take as much of Syria as they can get, certainly swallow up Lebanon. They want the whole region. Iran is the only state in the area that has the ability to really stop that. So if you can wipe out, if you can get the United States to come in and do the dirty work, then you've got the red carpet rolled out for massive expansion in the region.
Well, and that's what at the same time that this is happening, though, of course, there's an effort among the BRICS nations to launch their own currency and to dethrone the dollar as the world reserve currency. The dollar is already in serious trouble. As you know, the U.S., $34 trillion in debt, and the annual cost just to service the interest on the debt is now over $1 trillion, mm-hmm. which is very frightening. At the same time, the U.S. dollar payments to nations, like you mentioned, Egypt and Jordan, those are essentially bribes to chill out. We're just going to buy your friendliness, let's say.
Right.
Well, and also, of course, the financial support to Israel itself from the United States, which is many billions of dollars a year. When the dollar really collapses, as I think it's headed there, although it may be a gradual erosion that just accelerates, when the dollar is less useful, then regardless of how many aircraft carriers you have, you lose the ability to project control over the Middle East. And how much of a role do you think that may play in where we are right now? Because time is on the side of Iran and Russia and China. Time is not on the side of the U.S. and Western nations, because the dollar is in a state of accelerating decline.
Oh, absolutely. There's a global realignment happening right now. There's a shift from the Western New World Order into a multipolar world. We're no longer top dog anymore. China has formed something that we can't stop. It's inevitable. And so you have the thing that keeps the United States propped up is the world's confidence in our ability to keep producing, to keep paying back the debts. They will keep buying our debt, our treasury bonds. We'll keep packaging the debt. The Fed will keep pouring money into all of the things that it does, the war industry and so forth. We'll keep shoveling the debt out to the rest of the world. They buy it, they invest. As long as we can keep paying the interest to the rest of the world that's buying our debt, everything's good. But the more it becomes clear that we can't do that, that's when we're going to see the dominoes fall. And one thing that could set that off potentially is if Saudi Arabia finally says, all right, you know what, we're going to get rid of the special petrodollar status that you have. As it is right now, the world, when they want to buy Saudi oil, they have to first trade their own currencies for U.S. dollars. The Saudi Arabia requires that their purchases be done in U.S. dollars. That keeps the demand for the dollar sky high. If Saudi Arabia decides we're no longer going to do that, and we suddenly overnight lose this high demand for dollars, if they no longer have to go buy our dollars in order to purchase the oil, that's going to cause a quick collapse. I agree with you that we're probably going to have a slow erosion, but that is something that could trigger something quick overnight.
Well, and my understanding is that's already a done deal, what you just described. The Saudis are going to drop the dollar requirement. I mean, the Saudis are joining BRICS nations coming up in early 2024, along with many other nations. And it's called, BRICS Plus. And Joe Biden has pretty much pissed off MBS over there. Mm-hmm. And The U.S. State Department doesn't know how to deal with the Saudis at all. Trump had a much better relationship, you know, regardless of what people think of Trump.
Sure.
He wasn't angering the Saudis, at least. And also, under Trump, we had more of a domestic energy supply, which made it more difficult for a Middle East energy embargo to hurt the United States economically. But right now, we're in the worst of all scenarios. I mean, the Saudis hate the United States now. We're dependent on the supply out of the Middle East to some degree. I know we produce a lot of energy domestically, but we no longer export a net amount of energy. We depend on the global supply in one way or another. And our currency is losing value. And all these other nations, they saw the U.S. weaponize the SWIFT system against Russia, which means that, hey, if we don't like what you're doing, we're just going to steal all your, you know, central bank deposits that are in dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars from Russia. So why wouldn't the rest of the world just reject the dollar at this point?
Well, that's what we're saying, it little by little. But the problem is the United States continues to use the, first of all, the CIA when possible. But if you can't get things done with the CIA, then you send in the actual U.S. military to soften things up and encourage nations to fall in line. You know, Venezuela learned that lesson just a few years ago. So what there would have to be a collective pulling away from the United States all at once. As it is, when it's just individual states, individual nations saying, well, we don't like what you're doing, we're going to pull back. We have the power over them still. We have the leverage over them still to isolate them and hurt them. So that's why BRICS is such a threat. The more that join in, the more collective resistance there is to the United States, the greater the threat. And we are in... we're in a transition period. Things are going to look very different. My children, when they're adults, it's going to be a very different world than what it's been like, the way society has been and the economy of the United States, the way you and I grew up. It's going to be very different.
Yes, clearly that's the case. Yeah. I want to remind people how they can follow you. It's Jake Morfonios. And at Twitter, your handle is Morfonios, M-O-R-P-H-O-N-I-O-S. That's pretty cool to have a last name that's half of Morpheus, by the way. And then you have the site, is that your site, Blackstone Intel? Is that right?
Right. Yeah, I'm so censored on back during my coverage of the Ukraine war, they slapped a big thing on my YouTube, my Twitter channel, where you can't see it. It's very hard to find it in search results. It's got tens of thousands of followers. But I created the second one, Blackstone Intel. So with only 1,000 followers on it, I actually get far more views than I do with the one with tens of thousands.
Wow. Okay. So BlackstoneIntel.com, that site is not up yet, or is that about to go live?
No, I found out that the Blackstone Intel, I had it. It was associated with an Israeli company. Was the provider, so I shut that website down, and I'm shopping for a new one now. So Blackstone Intel is not up as a website right now.
Okay, wow, yeah, you have to dance around these days just to be able to stay online, given the nature of what you're saying. Now, in addition to is it primarily the Middle East that you have monitored and reported on for all these years?
Mostly the Middle East.
Yeah. Okay, so do you find it interesting or perhaps alarming? I don't know, but it seems like this incident that's happening right now, or war, is garnering the attention of more Americans and more Europeans than and people around the world than ever before. Yeah. I don't even remember in my lifetime ever paying this much attention to Palestine and Gaza and the history of that conflict. But now I've had to get educated very, very quickly about a lot of things that are frankly quite shocking to learn. But I think a lot of people are in my shoes right now. Do you find that to be the case?
Yeah. And it's been very refreshing to see so much interest this time around than in the past. It's a topic that in the past, when I would try and talk to people about it, you'd see eyes roll up in the head and yawning, and just has nothing to do with me. But the availability of video footage coming from Palestine is far more ample than it has been in the past. People can see it. They don't have to just take someone's word for it.
Right.
You can't, now you can see it. You can see, I do have a Telegram channel, Blackstone Intel, where I post things there that I can't post on Twitter or anywhere else. And it's gruesome and it's horrible. And I don't recommend it to regular people because it shows the true horrors of war, of warfare. And what's, but people see these things and they're stunned. They're traumatized by it. And they wonder, how can this be happening? And the civilized world is allowing this to go on. It just, people are dumbfounded and they're really waking up, not only to what Israel has been doing to the Palestinians for decades, but they're coming to realize, wait a second, the world is not what I thought it was. The power is not in the hands of the people. The power is in a small elite class that control our politicians, with the banking class, with the investor class. And it's like they're being red-pilled in real time, and you can see this happening. And this conflict, the issue going on in Gaza, is leading people into that. So we're seeing all kinds of benefit in terms of people learning and gaining greater education because of what's happening. And yes, I'm really encouraged by that.
Well, and here's something that I found very shocking, and I know you've probably witnessed this for many years, but the way Israeli people tend to talk about Palestinians amongst themselves is so racist and so atrocious that when they speak to an international audience, you know, on an online video or whatever, they think it's perfectly normal to refer to Palestinians as animals or to say, kill them all, kill them all, kill the children. And but the rest of us, at least in the United States, many of us, and I'm sure in Canada and so on, we're looking at this like, oh my gosh, is this what these people believe? That you can just kill all the children? And that is what they believe.
Right, it absolutely is. And I spent time over in Israel and the Palestinian territories. And I can tell you that I met, when I was over in Palestine, I had dinner with the mayor of Ramallah. I had meetings with people from politicians, lawyers, civic groups, journalists, down to Palestinian olive farmers out picking olives with them. I interviewed dozens of people while I was over there, and it didn't matter what their status was. Every single Palestinian, and I talked to people on the street, just random people, stopped them and talked to them. Not one person ever expressed hatred toward Jews. Not one of them ever said anything that could be seen as a desire for Jews to be thrown out of the land. What the people want from top to bottom is the ability to live in peace. If the Jews are there, fine. But the Palestinians want the same thing that the Jews have, which is self-autonomy. They want the dignity that comes from having the ability to vote for their own representatives, to choose their own form of government, to control their own streets, to police themselves, to have a military to protect themselves against invasion. They're not asking for anything that the Jewish people don't have. Now, I also spent time among the Jews, and while there were plenty of peace activists that I met with, I had a very different experience. My first night in Israel, I went up by myself, which in retrospect was maybe not the smartest thing to do, but I went up to the Mount of Olives. I wanted to see this historic place where Jesus and the apostles spent time and looked down on it. And from up there, from the vantage point, they've still got some olive trees up there. You look across, you see the Dome of the Rock. Well, I was up there one evening, not bothering anyone, not on, just in a public area, a place where during the daytime there's plenty of tourists. First of all, there was one group of people, of Israelis, that came up to me and surrounded me. They were teenagers, teenage boys, and they just walked in circles around me, almost like a wolf pack, you know, just not saying anything, but being intimidating. Like, all right. They left. A few minutes later, as I was standing near the road, a car pulled up, and a bunch of men got out, Israeli men, and they did the same thing. They didn't say anything. Huh. They came up to me and they just glared at me.
Wow.
And they got in their car and they left. And so after this, I decided, you know what, maybe I'm in the wrong place. So I went up to, there was a little hotel there, an Arab hotel, to call a taxi to go back to my hotel. And I got talking with them, and they said, oh, yeah, that's a settlement right up here. And that's how they treat people. I thought, okay, maybe this is isolated. Then I was on a tour throughout Jerusalem. I had rocks thrown at me, not big stones, but like handfuls of pebbles thrown at me. Look up, and settlers up in homes in East Jerusalem that they had taken from Palestinians. Now, I'm not walking around wearing a Palestinian flag or a keffiyeh or anything that would identify me that way, but there was hostility toward me. Then, though, I went through the Arab quarter, and as you walk through the corridors, open air, you've got shops on either side, school kids walking back and forth to school, all the shop owners selling their herbs and different things, but they had chicken wire over the top. And I noticed a lot of trash up there, and I asked someone about it, and they started pointing out things I hadn't noticed before. There were bottles, there was used toilet paper, and bottles of urine, big pieces of stones, glass, things that the settlers who are kind of live, their homes are built above this, they throw it down on the school children as they're walking back and forth. Wow. So the Palestinians had to put the chicken wire there to protect themselves from getting hit. I went to Hebron, which is Al-Khalil in Arabic. Hebron, as I was walking through, I came out of the Abraham Mosque, saw where Abraham is buried, and came out, and I was stopped at a checkpoint. Everywhere you go, you have to go through these checkpoints. It's like you're in a prison, barbed wire, turnstiles. I come out of a checkpoint. I'm walking around looking to see what I want to take a picture of, and Israeli soldiers walked up to me and detained me, Israeli security forces. They started questioning me, asked me why I was there. Very hostile, not like, hey, how are you doing? What you know, we want to ask you a few questions. Very hostile. Grabbing my clothes and saying, what is this? Why are you wearing this? Took my passport, called it in, put my name on some kind of list.
Wow.
Now, what I did not know was that I was carrying my camera gear. I was taking photos. What I didn't know was that a few days before, the day I came walking through, the security forces there had shot a Palestinian man, just a civilian, hadn't done anything. Killed him right there where I was at, and they thought I was there trying to do a report on that, and that turns out that's what they were so upset about.
Oh, wow.
So I had a very different experience. Everywhere I went in the dealing with the settlers compared to the Palestinian people. Now, I don't want to broad brush and say all Israelis are like that, because they absolutely are not all like that, but there is a marked difference between the common Israeli and the common Palestinian. One side has the power, and so they want to be the ones to set the agenda. And the agenda is, you Arabs don't get to live here. You have to leave. The land is ours. God gave it all to us. It doesn't matter that you and your fathers and forefathers have lived here for centuries. We are going to take it. It's ours, and you get no part of it. It is a system of apartheid that is unsustainable. You cannot expect to ever have peace when you have your boot on the throats of somebody's children. And that is how it is over there. So while I do not support in any way violence from Palestinians against Israeli civilians, I understand the context of it. I understand this untenable situation that has been perpetuated by U.S. imperialist support for the Zionist regime. And well, I understand the frustration of what the people are experiencing.
I'm glad you mentioned that you understand the context, because I think from the point of view of a lot of, let's say, Christian Americans, all history in the Middle East began on October 7th. And,
right.
Right. And there was right. It was unprovoked. Nothing happened before then. And then suddenly, out of the blue, this right. is,
for
we
no
hear this.
At all.
Right. No, it's kind of like we hear this with Ukraine, too. It's like, Putin, out of the blue, suddenly decided right. to attack Ukraine unprovoked for no reason. He's a madman.
Let's ignore that since 2014, there's been an assault going on against the people of Donbass.
And, exactly.
You know, 10,000 people killed by the Ukrainian military.
Right.
you know, an attempt to cleanse the area of all Russian influence, despite the people being ethnically Russian. Yeah, let's not look at any of that. Let's just say it all started with Putin, and he's the modern day Hitler, and take it all out of context. That's the problem with it. And fortunately, while the mainstream media perpetuates that kind of ignorance, the good thing is social media does provide an opportunity for there to be kind of intellectual warfare, for each right. side to present its evidence and for people to consider it. And that's where the battlefield is. And that's where we are. This side is making a lot of progress, a lot of gains. May not result in immediate political change, but it is changing hearts, it is changing minds, and it's waking people up to the simple fact that there's a whole lot more out there than what they've been exposed to in the past.
Yeah, I'm hearing, I agree with everything you just said, and I'm hearing more calls among Americans, and I'm not even talking about pro-Palestinian Americans mm-hmm. or certainly not pro-Hamas. I'm just talking about everyday Americans who are realizing what's going on here, and they're saying, why are we funding Israel? Maybe yeah. we should just stop sending money to Israel, number one. Why do we have the U.S. military, especially the Navy, protecting Israel's borders when we're doing nothing to protect our own borders? Why are we sending money to Ukraine and Israel while our cities are falling apart in the United States, where we don't have enough police and there's mass looting and shoplifting to the point where retail establishments are shutting down and so on? I mean, these are common sense questions. Why is it, you know, Israel first, Ukraine second, and America last?
Yeah. Yeah. People are starting to ask that. And when you show them the numbers, like, okay, fine. We're giving billions each year to Israel. All right. But no one stops and asks, do they need the money? Israel runs a budget surplus year after year after year. They don't need the money. It'd be like, instead of giving money to a homeless person, you instead see somebody in a three-piece suit stepping out of a limousine, and you go over and you hand them your money while you don't have enough money to pay for your own kids' dinner that night.
Right.
It makes no sense. But that's what we're doing. That's the dynamic between us and Israel. They don't need our money, but they get it. And what a lot of people don't know is that a lot of this money that goes to Israel from the Federal Reserve, what Israel does is they don't even spend it. They turn around and they reinvest it, and they make money off of the money we gave them. So they're earning wow. money off of it. While, just like you said, we've got inflation, we've got all the troubles that we do here. So people need to wake up and say no more foreign aid to Israel. I'm kind of libertarian in that I don't agree with foreign aid of any kind to anyone.
Right.
But at the very least, let's balance it out. Don't be sending money over there or weapons over there to perpetuate an apartheid occupation.
Well, and this is, I'm glad you mentioned, you have kind of a libertarian take on this. I've thought the same thing, where I've asked, why can't the U.S. just have a stance where, hey, Middle Eastern countries, we'd like to buy your energy. We'd like to engage in a fair free trade exchange. We'll send you money, you send us oil, or right. we'll trade corn for oil, or, you know, something yeah. freedom-based. Instead, it's like, no, Israel is a beachhead. We need to have a military threat and coercion against Middle Eastern countries. Even RFK Jr. said this recently, that Israel's a beachhead. We got to have Israel because we have to put yeah. pressure on the Middle Eastern nations, which means military threats. You know, why can't we engage nations in trade instead of coercion all the time? This is all the U.S. knows how to do. I mean, cutting off Russia from trade, mm-hmm. we don't need to fight every country in the world. All we need to do is trade with them, for God's mm-hmm. sake.
That's right. But see, you're trying to make sense. You're trying to use logic and speak from a position of morality. That's morality and common sense and decency does not make money. The United States is trying to expand empire. It's trying to dominate. This is imperialism. And so what you're saying is maybe right. It may be moral. It might be the smart thing to do, but it doesn't make the investor class money. Not the kind of money that they can make through the way that they're doing it.
Right.
The oil wars and everything else. How is Genie Oil going to be making money if you're trading corn for oil? They don't want corn.
Right. And they want war, because I mean, even think about so much of the money that was supposedly spent on Ukraine actually went to U.S. weapons manufacturers who haven't even delivered most of those weapons to Ukraine. And by the time they even have those weapons, Ukraine's probably done. They probably already signed, you know, a peace accord or something with Russia where Russia sets the terms, by the way. Mm-hmm. And then those weapons will never go to Ukraine. So it's really just corporate welfare in America to Raytheon and Lockheed Martin and Boeing and whoever else is making weapons.
That's right.
It's what it is. What a racket.
It's absolutely what it is. An absolute racket.
Yeah. All right. Well, Jake, we're about out of time. What do you want to leave our audience with today?
I guess if I could leave one thought, the wish of my heart is for people to be a little more moderate in their approach to these controversial issues. Recognize that there's almost always more than one side to the story. And so when you hear the mainstream US media pushing one side of the story, just know there's always another side. And be courageous enough to stand against the crowd and investigate it. And if they want to label you for it, call you a Putin lover or a terrorist sympathizer or whatever, anti-Semite, just deal with it. Just take a look at the information anyway and use the brain that you've been given to make up your mind for yourself. Don't go along with believing something just because that's what the crowd thinks, because the crowd is often dead wrong. The crowd is often only going, making their decisions based on what the corporate media is allowing their minds to consume. And that content is only going to present one side of a story. And you're never going to be on the right side of history when you're only listening to the propaganda of one side. So let yourself consider all of the facts. Seek out opinions and information from sources that you know you're probably going to disagree with. At least listen to it. You don't have to decide that you agree with it. You can still have your beliefs, but at least look at it and you can refine your position based on the additional information. The other side often has at least some elements of truth to what they're saying. Incorporate that, refine, be independent in your thinking. Don't be tribal in your thinking. Think for yourself.
Very wise words there, Jake. That was an excellent summary of critical thinking. And that's exactly what we need right now. And also, I would say, along with that, the courage to stand by your conclusions. Once you go through that process, don't be easily swayed because, you know, five of your friends said, no, you have to stand with fill in the blank.
Right.
You know?
Absolutely.
I mean, I think that most people, they're not even bothering to think or do research. No. They're just going with the flow.
Whatever the tribe or the herd's talking points are, you just regurgitate that without even thinking it through.
Right, right. No, I heard a lot of that also during the COVID years as well. It's all been pretty crazy. But this has been a fascinating conversation. I want to thank you for taking the time to join us today. It's been really great. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate you having me on.
Absolutely. It's been very enlightening. We appreciate you, Jake. And folks, again, Jake Morfonios is the name of our guest today, and his channel is at Morfonios on Twitter or X. And you can also, are there any other platforms, Jake, that you want to mention, or any other, or YouTube, you said, right?
Blackstone Intel on YouTube is where I publish most of my videos.
And then Telegram, what's your Telegram channel?
Blackstone Intel.
Blackstone Intel. Okay, great. I would tell people go to Telegram because, I mean, you know, YouTube can censor you at any moment. Use Telegram, but also you're welcome, by the way, Jake, to join Brighteon.com. So feel free to post your videos on Brighteon.
Thank you.
If it's like crazy graphic, like murder videos, we will not allow those, by the way.
Right.
But which I guess that's every day now in a hospital in Gaza from bombs. Right. You know, it's crazy. But try not to make it like, you know, crazy violent videos. It's crazy. I have to even say that in our world today, but that's where we are. You know.
It's
wild. Absolutely. All right. Well, thank you so much, Jake. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Mike.
All right. Take care.
Bye bye.
And thank you all for watching today. Again, Jake Morfonios, first time we've had the honor of being able to interview him and get his analysis. So thank you for watching today on Brighteon.com, free speech platform, as you can tell. And I love what Jake said there right at the end. Think for yourself. and don't be swayed by popular opinion, because popular opinions are very often, if not usually, wrong. If you follow the herd, you're just going to follow them off a cliff, by the way. So think for yourself, Brighteon.com. Thanks for watching today. Mike Adams here, the founder of Brighteon. Take care. Today's program is brought to you by Goldbacks, and you can go to my website, verifiedgoldbacks.com, in order to see all our lab testing results of these really innovative bills that have physical gold embedded in them. I've got a little stack of them in my hands here. These are the one Goldbacks. Each of these contains quite literally 1/1000th of a troy ounce of gold inside the bill. The gold is actually in there. And there are other denominations, 5s, 10s, 25s, and 50s. The 50, of course, contains 50/1000ths of an ounce of gold. And I didn't even believe that at first. And so I acquired a bunch of these and I did the testing. If you go to my website, verifiedgoldbacks.com, you can see the laboratory testing that we did. And here I am. I bought a kiln. I did the meltdowns. We used acid also, you know, nitric acid here, did a dissolving into a mass spec analysis in my laboratory. Here's some of the melted gold that came out of the kiln test, and here's some of the weights and so on. On this website, you can see, let me scroll down, you can see the actual recoveries. There's some of the gold foil that comes out in the first melting. There's the picture of the kiln. And there's some, well, different photos of the dust and everything that comes out. Bottom line is in this chart right here. The recovery that we got, the amount of gold that we got out of these bills, it was over 100% of the claimed amount in every single case. The lowest we got was 102%. The highest we got was 107%. And then we did ICP-MS testing here. And these are the results we got showing that it is better than 99.99% atomic gold, which makes it better than 24 karat gold. So, bottom line, not only are the Goldbacks real, not only do they contain the gold that they claim to contain, and it's pure gold or, you know, 24 karat plus in purity, but they're highly divisible. So I can take these and I can, you know, I can give somebody or I can pay for something with 1/1000th of an ounce of gold, which I can't do that with a coin. Like here I have silver coins, but I can't take like a pair of scissors and cut off 1/1000th of an ounce of silver or gold. It just doesn't work that way, and I would ruin the coin. So Goldbacks make gold really usable, divisible, and it works in an off-grid situation. Power grid goes down, you may not have access to your crypto. You certainly won't have access to your bank account in that grid down scenario. These work. These work, and the gold is instantly visible. Goldbacks are becoming increasingly recognizable, and people love the way they look, and they love to hold on to these, and more people are willing to take them, even as merchants, for purchases. So go to verifiedgoldbacks.com to learn about these. This is an affiliate site. We do earn a small commission on the sales of these at no additional cost to you, so it does help support this platform, but you'll get these in your hands. Now, you might ask, well, what's the price of these compared to the price of actual gold? Okay, it is cheaper to buy raw gold by itself per ounce if you just want a gold coin or a gold bar. This has a premium over the price of gold because of the format and the divisibility and the precision and the printing technology and all of that. But it also means these have value over gold as they are accepted and recognized by merchants. So if you just want raw gold, you know, get gold coins. But how are you going to divide them up? How are you going to really use them in day-to-day transactions? If you want usable gold, Goldbacks are a great solution for that. And I think these can be part of every person's preparedness. If you already have gold and silver, maybe you already have garden seeds, maybe you already have other assets, but do you have Goldbacks yet? This is something important to add. And they also make really incredible, highly educational gifts. I've been tipping waiters and waitresses at restaurants with this, and then I have a little conversation with them about real money. Like, this is real gold, you know, versus fiat currency. And you can give them as gifts to family members, you know, birthdays and holidays and whatever else, and you can teach children or grandchildren about what is real money, and they will hold on to these because the artwork is amazing, they're beautiful. People will hold on to these, and they'll see the value rise as the value of gold rises. Because these contain physical gold. As gold goes up, Goldbacks go up versus the dollar that's going down. And who knows in how many years, you know, what these will be worth versus the increasingly collapsing dollar. So I don't encourage speculation, just to be clear. I'm not saying speculate in it, but just to hold on to value that you have right now, just to kind of freeze, you know, your savings. I don't trust that the dollar is going to be here 10 years down the road. I know the dollar is not going to hold its own value, but I have absolute certainty that gold is going to continue to hold value. And as dollars drop, that means the price of gold in dollars will be rising, even if gold itself is still worth the same in terms of purchasing power. But in dollar denominations, gold will appear to be going up in terms of dollars. So that's something to keep in mind. Now, do your own research. I'm not your financial advisor, obviously. Do your own research. Get your own experts. Do what's right for you. Only you know your financial situation and your risk and so on. And could these go down in value? Well, if gold goes down, these will go down in value. If you think gold's going to go down over the next 10 years, then, you know, maybe you can buy Apple stock or something. I don't know. But if you think gold's going to go up or hold its own, then this is a great way to have physical gold in a usable form. So check it out at verifiedgoldbacks.com. And thank you for supporting us also, but more importantly, you know, thank you for protecting your own assets. We're going into some very interesting times in the years ahead. Thanks for watching. I'm Mike Adams for Brighteon.com. Take care.